Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hi, I'm Robert Arneson of The Western Producer. Welcome to another edition of Between the Rows. First up on today's show, thanks to frost, flea beetles, and dry weather, many crops in Western Canada were in rough shape back in June. But with timely rains and warmer weather, wheat, canola, and other crops have bounced back on the prairies. In late July, Neil Townsend, senior market analyst with FarmLink, traveled across part of the prairies and had an up-close look at this year's crop. Neil joins us now from Winnipeg to talk about the 2019 Grain World Crop Tour. Hi, Neil.
Hey, how you doing, Robert?
Thanks for coming on the show. I appreciate it. So I guess, first off, can you kind of like describe this crop tour to us? Where did it go in Western Canada?
Okay, so this is the second time we've done that, this crop tour through Grain World and FarmLink. So basically, we have a bunch of teams out in the prairies starting from different points. We had several cars starting from Winnipeg, a few cars starting from Saskatoon, and then other cars in Alberta and other parts of Saskatchewan, Manitoba, kind of doing tours. And it was 2 days of touring starting on July 30th, and including July 31st. The cars stopped at farmers, lots of farmers who, you know, we'd set up beforehand, FarmLink clients or other interested farmers, plus some, you know, slightly more random stops. And we just kind of looked at the crops, and then we convened in Regina. All the cars eventually got to Regina and reported in their data, and we had a presentation in Regina on August 1st of the data that was collected from the cars.
And so when you say data, can you explain that?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, we're looking at fields, you know, doing formal counts in some and doing, you know, more or less eyeball testing others to try to determine what the yield potential is at the time that we see it. I mean, there's various crops out there in Western Canada. Some are easier to calculate than others. I mean, there's, you know, tried and true methodologies for wheat and barley and those kinds of things, whereas something like canola is a lot more, you know, art than it is science in terms of counting what the potential yield might be. And I mean, that's something to always remember. There is a degree of subjectivity to crop testing, crop reporting. That's why we have, you know, multiple cars and multiple people in each car so that we get as many different opinions as possible. And hopefully, you know, somehow, some way, the differences even out and we get as close to a true picture of what the crop potential might be. That's why the more people scouting, the better.
Okay. So given that data you gathered and the observations, what were some of the major findings from the tour?
Well, I mean, you know, there's some things that we wanted to know that, you know, maybe don't involve even going into the field. Like, I think, first of all, there was a significant drought threat in Western Canada in, you know, May and June. And so we wanted to see, you know, how do crops look after that drought, you know, threat. Second thing is, you know, we've heard varying reports of a variability in other parts. So maybe the eastern part of Manitoba we've heard has been pretty dry. So we wanted to see, is there now some sort of drought threat there? Second thing is, crop mixture. Like, you know, the markets have been challenging for many of the crops that Canadian farmers grow. In particular, canola highlighted as being maybe the most challenging because of the politics. So we wanted to see, you know, did farmers maybe act with their planting to kind of, you know, lessen the risk. And so we were looking to see in certain areas to see whether or not other crops maybe had gained some acreage toehold because farmers had backed off canola.
Okay. So one thing I observed on my leg of the tour, which was from Winnipeg to Weyburn and then part of the way to Regina, was that, you know, it seemed like there's less canola around, and in southeastern Saskatchewan, more flax. What did you see on your leg of the tour?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that was the general reportage that we got, in particular in that southeast quadrant of Saskatchewan, was that, you know, the farmers had taken some canola out and put in flax. And other people reported seeing in some other areas, maybe, you know, a couple extra fields of flax or even a little bit more pulses than they might otherwise have thought. I think the word from Alberta was that they saw more peas than maybe they previously thought they were going to see, and that might have come at the expense of canola to a certain where the rotation could be adjusted to fit in an extra field of peas at the expense of canola, maybe changing fields around a bit. So yeah, that would be something that we said, and it most likely we're probably going to lower our canola seeded acreage estimate a little bit here. We're not talking about major acreage, not like a half million or a million acres, but we're probably going to take it down between 150 and 250,000 acres.
Okay, so but down definitely. That was it. Kind of one of the takeaways here.
Yeah, I'd say like there's two takeaways on canola. One was that there definitely wasn't more acres than what StatsCan thought or what we previously thought. There's probably, our number was a little higher than Statistics Canada, so we have room to move down towards Statistics Canada. And we might move just a little bit below Statistics Canada in terms of where we see the canola acres at. The other observation we made about canola, and again, this is always sort of the $64,000 question in Western Canada, at least over the last half decade or more, is that, canola was the crop that we saw probably the greatest amount of variance in overall. And we noted that there was a lot of canola that was flowering, and we thought that was a little bit late to be flowering. And so we just thought that even, the ordinary first frost dates in Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta could potentially threaten a proportion of the canola crop that's just kind of lagging a little bit behind.
Do you have a sense of why a lot of the canola crop was still blooming in late July? Was it because of reseeding or poor emergence, or what's your sense of that?
I think it's a combination of a variety of factors. I mean, I think, the poor emergence is probably the largest single factor. There was some early season frost that happened in parts of Manitoba and maybe Saskatchewan as well, that there was a little bit of canola reseeding. We heard about that. But I would say the number one thing is just that, the crops in general got off to slow starts because, preponderance of the Western Canadian prairies were under some sort of drought watch. And whereas the grasses and the cereals, they sort of, they got that a juice of water, and that was what they needed, and they've really rebounded and come back. I think canola is just showing like a little bit slower recovery from that. That doesn't mean that it doesn't have potential. I mean, betting against canola is sort of a sucker's bet in Western Canada. I mean, I if you had to ask me, like, what's the one from all the crop touring I've done over the last decade and a half, like, what's the one consistent thing? The one consistent thing I'd say is that on average, the canola you see when you do the crop tour tends to get better by harvest time. So, if you estimate X at the crop tour, it could be X plus two or X plus three or even X plus five bushels an acre by the time you harvest it. I don't know if that's going to happen this year. It seems a little more risky, but it's just, I'm cautious. I'm very cautious about cutting yield potential from the canola right now. That being said, Robert, like, we do see canola more in like the average range, not in the above average range or sort of like trend plus yield right now.
So, I mean, there's different definitions of average. I mean, in parts of Manitoba, people think of average canola as like 50 bushels now. I mean, how do you define average across the prairies?
Well, we define it like it's a proportionality thing. Like, like, for example, Saskatchewan, where there's more acres in, like, their average is more a proportion of the prairie average than Manitoba, right?
So
Manitoba has a lot of canola, but it doesn't have as much canola acres as Saskatchewan. So, the average is brought down by Saskatchewan, and Manitoba in general brings the average up. But, I mean, because there's fewer acres in Manitoba, Saskatchewan sort of wins out to kind of, pull it down closer to 40 bushels, whereas, a lot of Manitobans would, their preference is to get 55 or even higher bushels per acre on canola.
Okay.
One thing, though, I will say about Manitoba this year is that, it was more variable than typical, including in sort of what we consider the garden spot of the prairies, the Red River Valley, where, definitely you can make a big argument that, some rain was needed for crops, and the crops that needed the rain the most in the Red River Valley are probably like, corn, soybeans, and then canola.
Okay, just shifting to wheat for a second here. So what did the tour say about sort of potential wheat yields? Is it looking above average perhaps, or what's your sense of that?
It's probably just on the cusp of being above average, but really it's close to the five-year average. And, I mean, what we saw with wheat was nice recovery from the drought. I mean, we didn't see a lot of impact on the drought. Now, when I say that, there's regions that are showing signs of strain. I mean, one region is southern Alberta. And, you know, what you notice there is not so much a one-year drought, but like a sort of a prolonged period of multi-year drought that's going on there. So there was some, you know, again, a lot of it's durum there, but the wheat that was there was, you know, struggling a bit more. Another region that we didn't actually touch on too much with the crop tour, unfortunately, just because, you know, we need some more boots on the ground there next year. So if there's any listener out there who's up in the Peace River District and would like to partake in the crop tour for next year, by all means, contact that Grain World or FarmLink, and we'd love to have you on there. But I mean, I think, you know, some of the parts of the Peace River are also struggling with moisture deficit and some problems with what their wheat crop might turn out. But overall, I mean, you know, particularly between Regina and Saskatoon, the area that was sort of concern because of the drought, we saw, you know, very nice wheat fields in general that have recovered from the drought and have, you know, pretty good potential right now. And in terms of our pre-crop tour estimate, we were thinking that the average would be 50.5 bushels per acre. And, you know, the final average for Canada, like for wheat, non-durum, we thought it went up by about 3% to 52.1 bushels per acre. So we, you know, we saw better wheat than we thought we might see prior to the crop tour.
So last one here. So obviously wheat, canola are the dominant crops in Western Canada. Did anything else that you saw kind of stand out for you in terms of other crops?
Yeah, I mean, again, I've mentioned it before and I talked about the cereals. I would say that the cereals look good. So, you know, our feeling about oats went up from the crop tour, you know, from before. And, you know, we thought that oats has potential to be about, you know, 1% to 2% higher than we thought before. And then the one that took a big leap, and actually a lot of the cars reported seeing very, very nice fields of barley. So barley yields actually from our pre-crop tour estimate to the post-crop tour estimate went up by 6%. So, you know, there's a lot of promise that. And then the final one I'll mention is just that, you know, people mentioned a lot of pea acres in Alberta. Bit of variance for sure. There weren't all home runs in the fields, but there were, you know, some pretty solid fields definitely of peas. So, you know, there looks like maybe, you know, on the yellow pea front that we might have a better chance to get a higher yield than our pre-crop tour expectations.
All right. Well, thanks, Neil. I've been speaking with Neil Townsend, Senior Market Analyst with FarmLink, about the 2019 Grain World Crop Tour. Thanks, Neil.
Thanks a lot, Robert. Have a great day.
In July, Tim Hortons began selling veggie burgers at its nearly 5,000 restaurants in Canada. Given that decision, it's safe to say that 2019 is officially the year of the meatless burger in Canada. Crystal Mackay, founder and CEO of Loft 32, a strategic communications firm that specializes in agriculture and food, is here to talk about veggie burgers and how Canada's cattle ranchers can respond to the new realities in the protein market. Crystal joined us from Guelph, Ontario. Hi, Crystal. Thanks for coming on Between the Rows.
Thanks for having me.
So as you know, last month, someone on the Weather Network went on Twitter and posted a tweet urging Canadians to eat less beef. I guess as part of an effort to save the planet, I suppose. So can you kind of remind us of what happened and what the reaction was from folks in the cattle industry?
Sure. So the Weather Network has a really active social media feed. So in addition to, you know, storm warnings, etc., they post all kinds of related content in their mind. So this was a post about don't eat meat, save for climate change reasons. And so the farm team, as I say, Ag Twitter, is really active. And immediately started responding, saying, you know, stay in your lane, that's not accurate, stick to the weather. You know, they got deluged with tweets, including people deleting the app. And so they corrected the video based on the number of people that, you know, we're the hungry, the number of people that are supposed to be in the world. But that made people even more angry because, you know, they're the beef industry responders said, you know, you corrected the video on the number of people in the world because that was factually wrong, but so was all your many of your allegations around beef. So I feel a good news story out of it is that representatives from the Canadian Cattlemen's went and met with people from the Weather Network and had the opportunity to start the discussion to say maybe some of the premises in your video were wrong. So that's a bit of background on that, but I think it's symptomatic of, it's just one tactic or one example of a general notion, I would say, that people have that don't eat beef, save the environment.
So yeah, so this has been around for a while that, you know, that cattle beef production, you know, is a major cause of climate change. And therefore, if you choose not to eat beef, you are sort of like helping the planet. I mean, in my mind, you know, that's pretty harmful to a brand of any product, that kind of idea out there in the public. Is it as bad as I sort of portrayed it there? Like, what do you? What's your sense of the public sentiment around all this?
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, the numbers are not as bad as I think the general health notion in terms of, you know, if we look at the stats, what people think. But I feel, I think it's more of a value sentiment that people feel, don't eat beef, it's not good for your health. Don't eat beef, it's bad for the environment. It's just a general sentiment that really intelligent people hold. So, you know, for a brand, a sector, and it really it's broader than beef, it's red meat, if we really categorized it, but beef tends to be the biggest target. It's definitely an issue of concern.
So then I guess the question becomes then, you know, it seems to me at least that avoiding beef and meat now is much more than, you know, just a dietary choice. You know, if you go buy a veggie burger at Tim Hortons, it's almost like it's, you know, as they say, like virtue signaling. You're kind of telling the world that, you know, I'm a good person. Again, is that part of what's going on here? Is that people want to be associated with something that is ethical and kind of on the right side of things?
Yes, there's definitely ethics and values as part of this discussion. So it's not just a matter of, well, here's the nutrient content of beef and here's the greenhouse gas emissions from beef. There is definitely a values-based discussion going on here. So save a cow is part of it, and that, you know, ethically, if I'm not eating an animal, then I feel better about myself. And then also to your point is this social, people defining themselves by their diet. So, you know, I'm a flexitarian. I do meatless Mondays, you know, whatever the trend is. So if I had some advice for the red meat sector, it would be, okay, let's embrace the keto, the powered by protein, the carnivores out there and the omnivores that right now are being guilted into not making those choices.
So can you just elaborate on that a little bit? Like, how would you go about sort of engaging with that segment of the public that, you know, as you say, are into this, I guess, what you call it, a ketogenic diet? Is that what the correct term is?
Yeah, well, keto, and like all meat all the time, you know, yeah. Less carbs, less sugar.
Yeah.
That's one. I mean, you know, that's the thing, right? There's so many diet trends out there. It's like, okay, I'm going to be, you know, vegetarian light, but I'll eat bacon, or, you know, there's just, it's complicated. So these labels, people are defining themselves by a label. Nobody introduces themselves at a barbecue like, hey, I'm an omnivore. They introduce themselves by, you know, they ask, is that gluten-free? Is that, you know, whatever they put the labels on. So I think it's really like trying to turn around the Titanic right now in terms of how do we shift these conversations away from meat is bad for you, meat is bad for the environment. This has been a long, slow build of negative media, not just media, negative conversations against red meat.
So I like that kind of shifting the Titanic or turning the Titanic analogy, because as you say, you know, this has been going on for a long time, and now we've reached the point where, as I said in my intro, veggie burgers are now available at Tim Hortons, like an iconic Canadian restaurant.
I guess the question becomes like response here. Like the tone of the response seems to me that's it's kind of critical here, because there are some people in the beef industry who say, listen, we need to stop this. We need to file lawsuits preventing these companies from using the word meat in their branding. What do you think of that kind of aggressive tactic to kind of really go after the veggie burger people?
I'm not a big fan of that style. It's not, I don't feel that's going to really change the conversation. So if you think about this as literally a conversation with Canadians. So picture we're going to have a giant barbecue, invite everyone over, and what's for dinner? And, you know, pounding the table and saying, don't call that meat, or you should be having beef, is not going to get someone to choose your product. So I think, I get the frustration. My family has beef cattle. I grew up with, I raised them myself, so I understand the frustration and how we take it personally. You know, it's against something that you feel so strongly about. But that's not going to work. The other thing that's not going to work is our own industry trying to promote itself is not going to shift the conversation, because it's just not credible. Of course you're going to say beef's not bad for the environment. You're trying to sell beef. So there's a couple of things we need to do. First is we need to stop being defensive and just say, you know what, here's all the protein choices on the menu, and here's the pros and cons. And the second thing is we need credible third-party voices to be part of those conversations, the dietitians, the doctors, university professors that study this stuff for a living. We need to give them a louder voice and get them to this dinner party.
So just to back up a minute here, so some people in the beef industry, in the cattle sector, might say, well, wait a second, we're the ones who raise cattle. We know about this. We understand this issue. We know a lot about beef. Like, why can't we stand up and defend our industry? Like, why not? Why do they need a third party to speak for them?
Well, it needs both. So you picture this dinner party, right? We absolutely need, specifically farmers themselves, farmers and ranchers need to be at the party and talking about cattle, not about nutrition, right? You know, I am an animal scientist. I know how to raise cattle. I don't know about iron versus zinc and, you know, what's digestible, even though I've read all about it. So I'm not credible there, and because I'm trying to sell the product. So the difference would be, if you're going to learn about a car, do you go to a mechanic or a car salesman? You want to go to the mechanic, right?
Right.
So farmers and ranchers are the mechanics of beef. So they need to talk about cattle, how they raise cattle, why we care for them, why we care for the environment, all those things that we have heard for. We are not effective when we're talking about the nutritional value. And that includes some of our associations that we fund. We see this shift in losing credibility in industry associations. So, of course, you know, blank of Canada or of, you know, Alberta, if you represent an industry, you're not going to shift a conversation to someone who's skeptical.
Okay. So I guess as I've watched this sort of evolve over the last decade, this kind of shift towards, veganism, vegetarianism in Canada, and kind of how that's taken off, and of course, what you might call ethical eating. Are you optimistic that the meat industry and the beef industry can kind of shift the narrative? Like, is this going to take years, decades? Like, what does this look like in terms of a timeline to the point where maybe people have, or the public once again has more faith or more belief that beef is actually, you know, an ethical choice, that it is something that's good for you? Like, is this a 10-year process? Like, how long is this going to take?
Yeah, well, to have the crystal ball is a tough question.
Yeah.
I'd say at least a 10-year horizon. It's going to take, I would say, at least 3 years for the hype to calm down around the Beyond Meat, which, you know, has really inflamed this conversation, because, you know, they're going direct into, I mean, vegetarian options have been on the menu since, you know, forever, right? That's not news, and but it's the way it's been marketed and so aggressively, etc. The fact that a restaurant like Tim Hortons or, you know, if McDonald's puts a meatless option on the menu, we need to take it as a who cares, so what, not make it a fight. So that's to go from not news to not being a fight, that's I would say a 3-year window. In terms of, am I optimistic if the industry, not the industry, if the conversation can change around, not if the industry can change it, I wouldn't have been maybe 6 months ago. But I have to say I've been part of the conversations with the Canadian Roundtable for Sustainable Beef, and I attended a meeting in Chicago with the Global Roundtable for Sustainable Beef. And some of the info that was presented there, which was literally things like eat beef, save birds, you know, and just talking about the wildlife benefits of grasslands, and there's so many good things happening that is absolutely not available to the public, or it's hidden in a scientific journal right now. So I would say personally, in the last 6 months, I've changed my mind, and I think that this conversation can shift, and there's some valid reasons why it needs to shift. The Canadian public deserves some credible information on this topic, both about beef nutrition and on the environmental impacts.
All right. Well, on that positive note, thanks for coming on the show. I've been speaking with Crystal Mackay, founder of Loft 32, a communications firm that specializes in agriculture and food, about the public relations challenges for Canada's beef industry. Thanks, Crystal.
Next up, the trade war between the United States and China took a turn for the worse last week. President Trump threatened more tariffs on Chinese goods, and China responded by allowing their currency to weaken. Joining us to talk about the trading chaos is Bruce Burnett, Director of Weather and Markets for Glacier Farm Media. Hi, Bruce.
Hi.
So thanks for coming on the show. So I guess it was about maybe 4 or 5 days ago that this new spat between China and the U.S. began. So I guess the value of the yuan is slightly lower now. What does that mean for this trade war and agricultural markets?
Well, I think the main impact is probably a little bit more psychological right now, in that the U.S. Responded very quickly, accusing China of being a currency manipulator, in fact, labeling them a currency manipulator, according to the Department of Treasury in the U.S. That really doesn't have a big material impact on what the U.S. can do to China itself, because, I mean, they're already putting tariffs on. So really, there's not a lot of policy options that this opens up, but it certainly does indicate that the Chinese have other tools that they could use, potentially. Ironically, I think recently China's been actually supporting their currency from dropping, especially with the continued prolonged trade war. It has had an impact on their economy. And you would have expected that their currency, the yuan, was going to drop actually over the period, and it had stayed rather stable. So that's one impact. I think the main thing is that when a country does see their currency get devalued, and it works the same way as we see in Western Canada when our currency goes lower, the products we sell abroad are cheaper and for countries, and that's going to be the case for China. So their exports should pick up. But the cost of the imports will also increase. So any of the vital imports that they need, especially in the food, fiber, metals, those types of things, oil even, are going to become more expensive in China, and that's probably going to dampen demand for those commodities.
And I guess the other news was China's threat or announcement that they're not going to be buying sort of U.S. ag commodities. Was that kind of what they said, or what was their actual message?
Well, I think the message was put towards state purchasing agencies,
okay,
of the Chinese government. And it was basically just stop buying U.S. commodities, which they'd been told that they should proceed with. And that was part of the original detente that we saw around the G20 meetings, where China offered to buy more U.S. commodities. The U.S. has actually accused them of reneging on that, although they have purchased a fair amount of U.S. soybeans over the past while. If they stop these imports, that just further heightens this idea that both sides are entrenched in their positions, and we won't see a lot of movement. And in that case, that certainly is going to hurt U.S. soybean exports at a critical time when we're going to see, although a smaller crop, still a fairly large crop come to harvest here in the upcoming months, and their largest customer probably not going to be there.
So the impact on Canada is that soybean prices are lower, therefore our canola prices are lowered. Is that the main impact?
Yeah, there's two impacts, I think. First of all, our soybean prices follow the U.S. soybean prices downwards. So for farmers who grow soybeans, those prices are lower. And the knock-on impact is, of course, in canola, because the oilseed markets are generally priced off of each other, and weaker soybean prices usually pull canola down as well.
Okay. So this is a shift our conversation here to kind of the U.S. Midwest. Obviously, you know, a horrible spring down there, extremely wet, difficult planting conditions. Where does the crop stand right now? How does it look, I guess, in early August compared to, say, when it was extremely wet 5 weeks ago?
Well, certainly the crop has started to grow, and I think the best statement about it is that the crops look very good for the middle of July. Unfortunately, it's now the first week in August. And so we're seeing the crops about 2 to 3 weeks behind normal in those regions. And there is a concern about the growing season, how long it's going to be, and whether or not these crops are going to see the yields drop dramatically because of the shortened growing season. So these are questions still yet to be answered. Unfortunately, there's not going to be a lot of clarity from the USDA in the August report on the 12th, because measuring yields on immature crops is a very hard thing to do. And so we won't see a lot of new news other than the planted areas and the potential harvested area. Those numbers should be a lot more accurate than they were in July.
So is that uncertainty kind of propping up the market right now, or is it not?
Well, normally it should prop up the market a bit. Unfortunately, with all the trade wars and other things in it, we're seeing weakness in the markets, and that's just generally because investors are fleeing towards the sidelines. The only commodity I think they're interested in right now is gold. All the others they're trying to sell or get out of. So I think there still needs to be a weather premium put into this market, and we'll probably see that after the USDA report and we start to get forecasts of what the fall weather or the early September weather is going to be like.
So we have the upcoming August 12th USDA report. Anything else that producers should be watching for in the next little while in terms of market signals or signs? What will you be watching for?
Certainly looking at those weather forecasts in the U.S. Midwest. The current forecast for the middle of August is for cooler than normal temperatures. Again, when you have a late crop, as we know in Western Canada in some areas, the last thing we really need are cool temperatures during August, because that certainly will delay the maturity and push us up against some of the first frost dates that you would see not only here but in the U.S. Midwest.
All right. Thanks, Bruce. I've been speaking with Bruce Burnett, Director of Weather and Markets for Glacier Farm Media, about the latest news from the commodity markets. Thanks, Bruce.
Thanks.
That's it for today's show. I'm Robert Arneson, the Western Producer. Thanks for listening.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.